Hey, I'd like to now introduce Dr. M.A. Grunbacher. Dr. Grunbacher works for the Acton Institute in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And there he is the chairman of the Center for Economic Personalism that publishes this new journal that's come out, Markets and Morality. Dr. Grunbacher has taught at Mount Aloysius College in Pennsylvania, where he was assistant professor of philosophy and theology, at the Milltown Institute for Theology and Philosophy in Dublin, Ireland. And he he did his doctoral work on the foundations of Austrian economics. He received his PhD in philosophy from the Milltown School in Ireland, Dublin, Ireland, his master's from the International Academy for Philosophy in Liechtenstein, and is a graduate of Steubenville, the Franciscan University of Steubenville. Dr. Grunbacher is an integral part of the Acton Institute, where both he and I have lectured together. And please welcome Dr. Gregory Grunbacher.
Good morning. The notion of a humane economy has existed since the time of Karl Marx, and indeed it was Marx and Catholic social thinkers of the late 19th century which gave birth to the term. Later in the early and mid-20th century, Wilhelm Röpke would borrow the term for a serious scholarship concerning culture, morality, and economic activity. Yet it would be fair to say that we still employ the term humane economy with a sense of expectation, namely that it has not fully matured. There is near universal agreement on the part of scholars analyzing the ethical dimensions of economic science and market activity that we are still in search of the humane economy, that we are moving ever so slowly toward this goal. The goal we appear to be seeking is not immediately apparent. If by humane economy is meant the better treatment of workers, socially conscious investing, fair competition, and so forth, the practical aspects of a humane economy, then given fallen human nature, we must continue to seek, knowing that we will fall short of perfection. However, if by a humane economy is meant theoretical structures and economic models upon which to pattern a third way between capitalism and socialism, then I assert that we are sadly mistaken in chasing after illusions. The quest for a third way is really an exercise in futility. Given the collapse of real socialism, our task must be to humanize capitalism because it is the only substantive game to play with. My intention in this short paper is to outline the parameters of a humane economy based on this humanization of capitalism and to briefly mention what I believe are some of the essential components. Merely describing its intellectual boundaries, as I will do, and its essential characteristics, will not provide the concrete practical material of humane economy. However, such a task is useful in that it serves first as a blueprint for those engaged in the concrete task of pursuing economic justice, and second, it helps to delineate useful scholarship on the subject from inappropriate models and polemics. The term humane immediately connotes a moral dimension. When we speak of the humane treatment of prisoners, or humane strategies for eliminating poverty, or even the humane treatment of animals, we directly sense that we are speaking about the moral implications of our behavior. More exactly, the term humane pertains to the appropriate conduct and treatment for persons. There is an implicit recognition of the immense dignity of the human person and his or her metaphysical status. The lofty stature of personal existence carries with it an embedded moral dimension. The standard of morality becomes the nature of the human person and his or her fulfillment. This is one way of speaking of what has been traditionally termed the natural law. If we focus on the preceding definition of humane as pertaining to the appropriate conduct and treatment of persons, we see that the project of a humane economy is essentially a personalist one. By personalist, I am referring to a specific philosophical and theological tradition that places philosophical anthropology at the heart of the philosophical and theological enterprise. Indeed, the humane economy is really an attempt at an economic personalism. The generation of an economic theory that is in accord with human nature, affirms human dignity, and pertains to the appropriate conduct and treatment of persons. Yet, for an economic personalism to generate a humane economy, it first must take both components of the term seriously. We must demand a theory that fully understands both economics as well as human dignity. Without this genuine synthesis, economic science and morality, the enterprise of a humane economy slips into either pious sentiments without any practical use, or an economic ideology which masquerades as legitimate moral theory. The rightful autonomy of both disciplines must be respected. the logic of the market and the logic of morality must be shown to intersect, and that the distinctions between moral science and economic science cannot be fused. Rather, it is the responsibility of any serious scholar to craft and develop a theory that is useful and coherent to both economists and moralists. The history of humane economics is filled with many failed attempts at synthesis. Nevertheless, it may be said that Wilhelm Rupke perhaps comes closest to a genuine synthesis of the sciences. A genuine synthesis would require the conjoining of insights from personalism, at least this is what we do at the center up in Grand Rapids, and economic theory that has proved capable of such dialogue. Ideally, this would involve the least mathematical theory possible, since abstruse econometric theories and models tend to confuse most philosophers and theologians. However, the same holds true for theologians and philosophers who are equally required to make their language and terminology more accessible to the economist. Personalism is primarily a philosophical and theological response to the reductionist denigration of the person brought about by positivism, Hegelianism, Marxism, and Darwinism. These philosophical ideologies all treat the human person as a consequence of external historical and environmental forces. Such treatment reduces the human person to a mere reactionary organism without freedom and on metaphysical parity with other elements of the created order. The human person is no better than the animals, and the environment of culture one-sidedly shapes the human person rather than the culture being engendered by the soul of the person. Personalism arose simultaneously in three intellectual centers of Europe during the beginning of the 20th century: Paris, France; Munich, Germany; and Lublin, Poland. Scholars from these centers of learning launched a project whose aim was a defense of human dignity and a fuller understanding of personal existence, borrowing from the best in classical, scholastic, phenomenological, and existential philosophy. Thinkers such as Emmanuel Mounier, Emil Brunner, Max Scheler, Karol Wojtyła, Jacques Maritain, and Gabriel Marcel analyze the basic issues of human life and human purpose. Although there are many different approaches among these thinkers, they share a common unifying theme of the personalist maxim. This maxim states that the person should be affirmed for his or her own sake at all times. This affirmation implies that a human person never be treated as a means to an end, and that human dignity be upheld and respected in political, social, cultural, and economic spheres. It is important to note that traditionally, any economic discussion engaged in by personalists usually took on a leftist or even a Marxist flavor. Mounier, Scheler, and even at times Maritain relied and borrowed from examples and themes from Marx and the various thinkers of the left. There existed an implicit and subtle demand for command economy, the limitation of economic liberty, and the curtailment of competition and other market forces. This desire to limit economic liberty was, of course, motivated by a desire to protect the individual and the family from the harshness of market forces and thus create economic structures that affirm human dignity. However, if we examine the work of the second half of the 20th century's leading personalist, Karol Wojtyła, more commonly known as Pope John Paul II, we see a shift away from the socialist ideas and a turn towards free market economics as the economic model of choice for dialogue. This is clearly seen in the Pope's 1991 social encyclical Centesimus Annus. In this insightful document, the Pope analyzes the fall of communism from a Catholic and a personalist perspective. He concludes, and I quote, "It would appear that on the level of individual nations and of international relations, the free market is the most efficient instrument for utilizing resources and effectively responding to human needs," close quote. The Pope is careful, as was Rupke, however, to avoid equivocating on the term free market. Later in the encyclical, he qualifies his endorsement of free markets by pointing out essential personalist features that must be present in order for the market to serve genuine human needs. For the Pope, a market that is genuinely free and personalistic is one that, quote, "recognizes the fundamental and positive role of business, the market, private property, and the resulting responsibility for the means of production, as well as free human creativity in the economic sector," close quote. History, economic reality, and the work of John Paul and other recent personalists such as Rocco Bottiglione, Josef Seifert, Michael Novak, and even our own work at the Center for Economic Personalism in Grand Rapids are now repudiating not the good intentions of the earlier personalists, but their reliance on socialist economics to bring about the common good. Socialism in its many forms has been proven a disaster on the practical level, as the wrecked economies of Eastern Europe and Russia attest. Whereas theoretically speaking, socialism has also been shown to be anthropologically and theologically flawed. Again, I quote from Centesimus Annus, "The fundamental error of socialism is anthropological in nature. Socialism considers the individual person simply as an element, a molecule within the social organism, so that the good of the individual is completely subordinated to the functioning of the social economic mechanism. The shift towards free market economic theory in personalist and Catholic thought is not, of course, an indiscriminate embrace of all that free market thought contains. Indeed, there exist variations of free market economic theory that are opposed to personalist principles and that insist on the superiority of market principles for all aspects of human life. This economic imperialism is a false theory of freedom and is not a contender for constructive dialogue with anyone serious about developing a humane economy. However, as can be learned from the example of John Paul, Christians, conservatives, and all those interested in humane economics can profit from a dialogue involving the better free market theorists, von Mises, Hayek, Menger, Becker, Stiegler, Knight, Rupke, Buchanan, Tullock, and so on. The Austrian, the Chicago, and the public choice schools of economics have much to offer those committed to constructing an economic order that has the potential to affirm human dignity, lift that people out of poverty, provide a solid basis for family life, and produce the necessary material goods and services for a good life. Again, I am not, nor is the work of the center, nor of any of the personalists, advocating a blind acceptance of all variations of free market economics. I'm a personalist first, and a Catholic as well, and only positive about free market economic theory in light of what it offers those truly seeking a genuine synthesis of economic science and moral science. These free market theories that I mentioned above and the theorists who promote them are worthy dialogue partners in the ongoing conversation of constructing a humane economic order. If we think about the economy for a second, we would be wise to avoid reification of the economy. The economy or the market can be understood really as a metaphor for the totality of the production, distribution, and consumption of material goods and services. This means that the totality of all voluntary exchange of goods and services is what makes up the market. All the buying and the selling, renting and trading and so forth that becomes institutionalized in things as such as banking, corporation, the stock market, and so forth. The primary social function of the market is to produce the necessary goods and services that make for survival and comfort. The economy directly provides housing, food, clothing, transportation, and even the materials necessary for cultural amenities. Excess wealth generated can be used for charity, investment, economic expansion, and other public projects. A humane economy would be one that is able to produce an abundant amount of wealth, yet this wealth would have to be produced justly, with the avoidance of greed, deceit, and fraud. Also, the process of production and indeed the entire economy would have to be open, resisting the erection of barriers to entry based upon unjust discriminations. Wealth would have to also be put to constructive uses to benefit the greatest numbers of individuals. And finally, that those who cannot participate in creative enterprise will maintain some sense of self-sufficiency and be provided for through charity. History has strongly attested to these goals being best attained through the promotion of economic liberty. Those most free to engage in creative enterprise, control their own property, and determine for themselves how to best apply their resources tend to be the most prosperous and even economically just. In addition, the poor and the marginalized also fare better in economies that thrive on free enterprise. Any survey of history and economic theory will offer enough evidence to support these statements. Economic liberty consists also in the following. First, a defense and a recognition to the right of private property. The entire Western tradition promotes this tenet. Individuals have a right to the fruit of their labor and have a natural justified ability to call something mine. Of course, this right, like others, is not absolute and carries with it other important corresponding duties. Yet it is a right which must be vigorously defended for the sake of the common good. Second, economic liberty further implies that individuals have the ability to exercise economic initiative, utilizing their property, their time, their talent, and other resources as they see fit, unhampered by excessive regulation and restrictions. Through a process of voluntary exchanges, individuals tend to improve their lot, increasing the efficiency and quality of their lives as well as their resources. Three, in order to ensure that mutually beneficial exchanges are not unduly restricted, thus hampering people from being productive and improving their own and other situations, external systematic restrictions need to be limited. This includes excessive taxation, reckless government monetary policy, unnecessary barriers to trade, ineffective safety regulations, complicated and unfair employment policies, and expensive licensing requirements. In all of these cases, the limitations of economic freedom come from unnecessary government intervention in the economic sphere. In fact, free markets are defined precisely in relation to the amount of government control present in the economy. The freer the market usually implies the less the government intervenes. Although government interventions are attempted for good and sometimes even noble reasons, most economists admit to the disruptive and even damaging effect of these interventions. Now, clearly, some intervention is required. A strong juridical framework is required for markets to operate effectively. The political institutions need to form symbiotic relationships with market institutions. Only an economic ideologue would call for absolute non-government involvement. Yet, it's important to note that we live in a statist day and age. Statism is the unhealthy reliance on a society, on the political institutions, to solve what are essentially moral and social problems, problems outside the natural scope of government, and therefore generally unresponsive to government action. This is the normal state of affairs today. When faced with the uncertainty and complexity of modern economic reality, from banking to foreign aid, from employment issues to tax policy, from mortgage laws to money funds, the desire for control, safety, and predictability is strong. It is frequently the government that is called upon to enforce the so-called stability that we seek. There seems to be much misunderstanding concerning unbridled capitalism and the extent that such harshness is imposed by market forces that are unbridled. Many have images of an unrestrained market wreaking havoc and destruction in family life, confusing moral understanding and creating poverty through the exploitation of the vulnerable. Terms such as radical individualism, consumerism, greed, and alienation are employed to give expression to these sentiments. And again, government intervention is sought to limit the destructive forces of the unbridled market. Yet the reality is that we live in a very bridled market. Our economy, as most economies of the West, are far from unrestrained. In fact, most, if not all, of the Nobel Prize-winning economists of the past 20 years, as well as the overwhelming number of economists and economic professors, cite excessive and unnecessary government intervention as the cause of many of our economic woes, and a call for the drastic reduction in such interventions. Study after study continues to demonstrate that economic liberty, when maximized, produces greater amounts of wealth and tends to create a better social environment where human needs are met. Underlying this philosophy of interventionism is a mechanistic understanding of the economy. It is viewed as a thing to be manipulated or controlled. If only those in government can pull the right strings, raise the correct levers, and push the right buttons, then the economy would function well. Yet the economy is not a machine to be programmed or operated. It is evident that those in government are often the least well-equipped to operate the machinery. Rather, the economy is a complex web of relationships, and these relationships, by their very nature, resist manipulation. Indeed, the freedom that each human person possesses by his or her own very nature demands an economic outlet as well. We tamper with the forces unleashed by these relationships at our own peril. Statism, of course, consists in more than economic restriction. It also comes in a moral variety. Increasing governmental imperialism has led to the encroachment of the political institutions in all social spheres. Government is now the largest provider of charitable efforts, educational efforts, and perhaps soon daycare efforts. The nanny state is alive, strong, and still increasing its reach. In doing so, it weakens the culture at large and disrupts other social institutions, robbing them of their natural functions. The end result is a weakened culture, confused and incapable of immediate decisive action. I need to be clear on this point as I come to my conclusion. I am not calling for an unrestrained market, nor championing unbridled capitalism. No sane defender of a humane economy could do so. Rather, I am recognizing the situation that we have an over-restrained market that in many cases interferes with the emergence of a humane economy. In addition, there is the subtler point that not all market restraints need be governmental. There exist other social institutions that can exert pressure on the market: families, voluntary associations, not-for-profits, religious organizations, and even educational organizations. Each of these sectors of civil society are capable of being a moral voice and presenting a strong moral challenge to market excesses. They are and need to be more restraints on the market, yet these restraints need to be moral restraints. Economic personalism advises that markets be freed from the restraints of statism and yet contained by strong and legal moral frameworks. Markets do not exist in a vacuum. Laws providing for fair employment practices, just competition, recourse to fraud, protection of property, the enforcement of contracts, and the provision of certain public goods are necessary for the free market to operate. A moral voice calling for charity, service to others, and fairness, while warning against greed and the idolatry of wealth, are also necessary. And indeed, personalism offers a theoretical structure for discussing the moral requirements of this kind of economic activity. The detailed anthropological insights of the personalist can greatly aid us in the creation of economic structures that affirm human dignity. Such a dual framework of moral and political restraints does not hamper freedom, but rather reinforces it, providing a safe space for its operation. Finally, generally speaking, the principle of subsidiarity is the guideline for determining the relationship between government and market. Yet it is also recognized that there will be legitimate disagreements concerning the exact application of subsidiarity. People of good intention will disagree about prudential matters. What policies are required to reform welfare? What processes should be implemented for taxi licensing? Which safety measures actually protect the consumer and avoid reducing productivity? On these matters, people will rightfully disagree, and the right course of action only becomes clear after periods of trial and error. In fact, it is in the realm of prudence that most supporters of a humane economy disagree. There are those who favor a larger degree of intervention in the economy than I do, and there are those who believe that my own set of policy choices would prove too intrusive. Our disagreements primarily concern matters of application and practice, and rarely erupt over theory or principle. To conclude, I think we need to be reminded of the fact that a humane economy needs to be the goal of every and each civilized man or woman, and that the preceding principles that I've discussed of private property, economic initiative, and the maximization of economic liberty serve to provide the motivations and guidelines for such action. The dignity of all requires a vigorous and energetic effort on the part of those who craft economic policy, perform scholarship in either economics, social theology, or philosophy, and above all by anyone directly in contact with the productive sector. This humane economy where human dignity is affirmed can only be achieved by a genuine synthesis that can happen when economists sit down to discuss things with theologians and moral philosophers. Sentiments cannot replace real principles of economics, nor can those principles of economics be imperialistically applied to non-economic aspects of human life. An economic theory and a moral theory useful to both economists and moral scholars is necessary if true progress is to be made. And I believe an economic personalism implies an advantageous paradigm for such progress and work. Thank you.